I'm Gail Harris, and for Dick Gordon, this is The Connection. Whether it carries all the news that's fit to print, or simply prints all the news that fits, any newspaper worthy of the name is fiercely protective of the firewall that exists between the opinions of its editorial pages and the content of its news coverage. That may be the reality, but the perception can be quite different. Witness the howls that came from some readers of the Washington Post when its editorial page came out in support of the war in Iraq. Many wanted to know what in the name of Katharine Graham the Post was thinking, and worried aloud when it then appeared the Post was getting any number of exclusives with inside information straight from the Pentagon. And then when the New York Times declined to support the war editorially, its news coverage became the target of conservatives who surveyed its headlines and accused the paper of rooting for Saddam to win. Connection listeners, do you pay attention to the editorial positions of your favorite newspaper? Do you see the firewall that is said to exist between editorials and the news? Or do you see opinions expressed by the editorial staff seeping into news coverage? 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call. That is 1-800-423-TALK. And with me this hour is Stephen Cole, who is managing editor of the Washington Post and a Pulitzer Prize winner for explanatory journalism. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, good morning.
Welcome to The Connection. We're delighted you could join us. I have to imagine that you have probably not been home much these last number of weeks.
It has been a busy month.
Are you at the point yet where you're having to show a photo ID, or what kind of hours have you putting in?
Well, long ones, but really it's a, it's been an extraordinary time the last 6 weeks, and with the kinds of risks and undertakings that our correspondents in the field have been putting themselves through, it's a small thing to be on the other end of the phone.
But a tremendous responsibility.
It's an important time for all of the media and for newspapers and for American society. It's true.
Why do you think Post readers reacted as they did to the paper's editorial support of the war? I know you got a tremendous amount of comment by email and letter, and I'm sure phone calls. Were you surprised by what you heard?
Well, I'm afraid you're sort of asking the wrong person. As you said in your solicitation for questions and comment, there is a separation in our shop between the editorial pages and the newsroom. And so quite a lot of the reaction that comes into the editorial pages does not cross my desk. And I literally don't see it, not because I'm not curious about it. It just isn't something that's part of my day-to-day work. I can speculate as well as anybody else that the editorial page did take a strong stand on a controversial war, and in doing so took a clearly spoken position than other newspapers and then this newspaper has done in the past, and that certainly among a segment of readers that was surprising and disappointing.
Well, I certainly don't want to suggest that that's part of your responsibilities, because of course it isn't. You are in charge of news coverage and not editorial opinion, but you had to have been reading those letters and had to have been aware of some of those comments, and I'm wondering if it meant that you felt you needed to walk an even more careful line in your news coverage to avoid any perception of bias.
Not really. I think that this is not a new issue for the newsroom, even though this was a particularly sort of emotional episode or an episode where there was quite a lot of dissent generated by the editorial page. It's by no means the only time in our experience as journalists in the newsroom where that's happened. And it's not the only time where it's happened on an important story that we've been trying to cover in a thorough and independent way, separately from what the editorial pages do. So, I hope that we create a newsroom where people come into work every day trying to do independent coverage from their own perspective. And while they may read the editorial page in our newspaper and a lot of other places to have a sense of where opinions are running, and sometimes for even fresh reporting on those pages, that's really not a significant part of the way coverage gets shaped or managed.
Let's talk for a moment about that firewall, because I'm not sure that every reader makes that distinction. Many people, I think, read the newspaper and find it all of a piece. So tell us a little bit about what it is, how careful people are to maintain it, and how do you reassure sometimes skeptical readers that there is such a thing and that it does exist?
Well, it's let me start with the first part, just how it works. You know, we are a privately owned corporation owned by our shareholders and by the Graham family, and they're the proprietors of the newspaper, and they operate the newspaper in a certain tradition, which presumes the independence of the editors in the newsroom, which is a policy that it's only their good faith that enforces day in and day out. But in fact, Catherine Graham and her son Don, who's now the CEO of the newspaper, enforces that rule and that way of managing day in and day out under enormous pressure. And I think that if you were to talk to not just myself, but dozens and dozens of other editors in the newsroom currently and in the past, you would discover that, in fact, it's extraordinary that he does maintain that way of managing and honors the independence of the editors, even when he disagrees with them, even when he disagrees with them severely. Separately from that relationship with the newsroom, he maintains a direct relationship with the editorial pages that is of a different character. The editorial pages are responsive to him, and he works directly with the editor of the editorial pages to craft the opinions that the newspaper expresses there. And so in an organizational sense, Fred Hyatt, who is the editor of the editorial pages, has a direct reporting relationship to the publisher, Bo Jones, and to Don Graham, the owner of the newspaper. And independently, we in the newsroom have a direct reporting relationship. And he manages those relationships differently. But in fact, we never talk with one another. We never attend any of their meetings. They never attend any of our meetings. I don't know what they're going to write about in the next day's newspaper. I would have to engage in all sorts of computer skullduggery to find out, which I don't do.
And probably prefer not to.
Prefer not to. I've got enough on deadline to worry about. And equally, they don't participate in any of our coverage meetings. They don't participate in any of our editing decisions. They don't talk to us about how we deploy our correspondence or what stories we think are important or unimportant. And they also don't solicit our advice about their opinions, frankly. So that's the way it really operates day to day. Now, you asked a second question, which is, are people skeptical about that? How can you assure them? And I think it's reasonable for people to be skeptical. I don't think people are nuts for wondering about how things work. And if I were on the outside, I would be skeptical for a couple of reasons. First of all, not every newspaper operates this way. Not even every American newspaper operates this way. There are newspapers, to my knowledge, where the editor of the paper is also the editor of the editorial pages. In Britain, that's a common arrangement, though I don't think it's universal. This sort of correctness that the Grahams and the Sulzbergers and other newspaper owners generally pursue at the big papers is, I think, actually unusual in the newspapering industry on a global stage. Certainly, you get outside the United States, even in France or Germany or Spain, never mind in the developing world, the newsroom is responsive to the ownership, and there is an interaction between the editorial pages and the newsroom that's different from what we do.
Stephen, I wonder how much, when readers look at newspapers, how much of their sense of tone comes not necessarily from the story, which might be very balanced, but perhaps from the headline, because I began my career in print. I know you've been a foreign correspondent and a reporter, and I suspect you would agree with me that there are few things more infuriating to a reporter than a headline which, to your mind, doesn't necessarily reflect the content of the story.
Well, it's true. In that sense, the format is a challenge. There is, you know, as much difference and value in a successful headline and a poor one as there is between a successful story and a poor one. And the way newsrooms operate, as you know from your experience, the headline gets written rather late in the process. And I actually think that there would be ways to improve the integration of headline writing with the other journalism that produces the story. Yet the way the system operates most of the time, the headline writer comes to this important task late and in some isolation.
That certainly seems to have been the problem that some conservatives had with the New York Times coverage, especially during that early weekend. You remember things did not appear to be going well for the U.S. and U.K. forces. There had been soldiers who were captured and some who were killed. Their pictures were on Al Jazeera and other Iraqi television. There was a lot of second-guessing, you'll remember, about the supply lines and in general about how the war was being run. I realize you're not speaking for the New York Times, but as a journalist, what do you make of those accusations by some of the more conservative press members?
Well, I'm not sure I know enough about their specific charges to comment in an intelligent way, but I do remember this period of second-guessing quite well because I was editing stories of a similar character. And the one thing that I believe is transparent in those stories, if you go back and read them in a fair-minded way, and maybe some of your listeners would disagree with me, but I think if you go back and read those stories, what you'll discover is that it was transparent in the stories that the dissent was actually coming from commanders in the field. This was not an invention of journalists sitting around in cubicles in Washington or even of retired Army officers solely, though they were quoted also. But that the primarily the sense of dismay about the initial resistance, especially from the paramilitary forces, was being reported from on-the-ground commanders who were distressed about what they were encountering.
And in fact, one of the quotes I remember, Stephen, if I can just jump in for a second,
sure,
was about how, and this was in a Post story, about how the enemy we're fighting is not the one that we anticipated, not the one we gamed against when they were laying out the various scenarios.
Precisely. That was General Wallace, commander of the V Corps, I believe, who gave that interview as he moved from Najaf towards Karbala and discovered that his supply lines were being harassed by paramilitary forces, the size and potency of which he hadn't, it seemed, fully anticipated. And secondly, a raid of Apache attack helicopters had gone poorly because it had encountered massed fire by paramilitaries and civilians in an urban area in a kind of Black Hawk Down-ish environment that alarmed them. It turned out that those events, which they worried forecast a longer and more difficult campaign than they had anticipated, were not accurate predictors of what was ahead. But I'm only arguing that the journalism was that. It was reporting, and it was a result, actually, of the Pentagon's decision to permit real-time access by knowledgeable reporters to commanders during the war itself.
We're talking about editorial independence and news coverage this hour with Stephen Cole, managing editor of The Washington Post. Connection listeners, are you concerned that journalists can sometimes be too close for comfort to the White House or Pentagon? Or if the penalty for editorial independence is being shut out from the news you need, is that an acceptable trade-off? 1-800-423-8255 is our number. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection. We're talking this hour with Stephen Cole, managing editor of The Washington Post, about editorial independence in times of war and the delicate balance that newspapers have to maintain between being close enough or too close to the halls of power. Right now, I want to bring in Eric Umansky into the conversation as well. Eric writes the Today's Papers column for Slate.com. Hi, Eric.
Hi there.
Glad you could join us. I want to ask whether you see this fuss about the Post being pro-war and the Times being anti-much ado about not much?
Yeah, I think it's much ado about not much. It's I basically agree with Steve. I think there might be the perception that the two things are influencing each other, the editorial pages and the news pages, but I don't particularly see it.
Well, these are giants in the field of journalism, but what about what you're seeing as you look at other newspapers around the country. I mean, do you see any signs of editorial positions being reflected, however obliquely, in news coverage?
Sure. I mean, I see some signs of that. I should say that I actually do. My job is to deal with the bigger papers. So in the bigger papers, I don't really see that. I mean, you know, the Wall Street Journal is a good example of that, which tends to have very conservative editorials, and the news articles don't reflect that, really.
What's your take on the Jessica Lynch story? I'm sure you wrote about it at the time. The Post was reporting that in its initial story that U.S. officials had said that she had fought until she ran out of ammunition, and then subsequently we found out that perhaps that wasn't quite the case.
Yeah, I don't know whether that's the case or not. I think that the coverage of Jessica Lynch, to the degree that it was sort of portrayed by the Post and others as a dramatic rescue initially, hasn't, at least so far, actually, according to the Post's own follow-up coverage, really borne out. And I think the papers and certainly the cable networks overplayed that angle.
Stephen, I should probably give you an opportunity to give us your cast on the Jessica Lynch story.
Well, I think it was a big story and an unusual operation that, as you know, was the first time that the American military had rescued a prisoner of war during combat, I think, in a generation. So it was an unusual event. I do think that the reporting about her circumstances, the circumstances of her capture, the wounds that she endured, and the full story of her recovery is incomplete. I don't think yet that any account, including the ones we've published, which described the initial intelligence reports about the circumstances of her capture, I don't think that's been refuted, but we don't know enough to know how incomplete it was.
And that brings us to another interesting point about exclusive stories and also about leaks, because that has been sort of an underlying theme of a lot of the coverage. There were a lot of reports, for example, starting last fall that outlined the American military strategy in Iraq and had an astonishing amount of details as to exactly what was being planned. So pull back the curtain, if you will, for us just a bit. How do these things happen? Does the official quietly call up the reporter or take them aside? You know, how do you get the kind of information that appears as an exclusive?
Well, you know, one person's leak is another person's enterprising scoop. But I think the one sort of popular image, even the word leaks, is misleading from all of the experiences that I see my colleagues having day in and day out, not just with this administration, but back through time. And I'm sure any reporter who's worked Federal Washington would tell the same story. It's these are not incoming calls. These stories are the result of determined, aggressive, independent reporting by reporters who are just determined to try to get behind official walls and veils. Now, when they interact with government officials, the attitude of those officials will vary depending on what agenda the officials are trying to pursue, what newspaper or media organization the reporter is coming from, and a million other sort of sources of complexity. But certainly the idea that anything like most of the stories of this character that you see in our paper or the Times or any other paper are initiated by the government is just a misunderstanding of the process.
So no more deep throats in the garage sort of feeding information, I guess. Let me ask you about this administration in particular, Stephen, because it's very tightly buttoned up, stays sometimes relentlessly on message. And in fact, the Post today has a story about how the White House has been completely incommunicado for the last several days. So how hard is it to get an exclusive story from inside the Bush administration?
Well, it's a very disciplined administration, one of the most disciplined that I think people in town can remember going back 20 or 30 years. It's both disciplined in terms of its internal cohesion. It's also disciplined as to journalism because they simply don't distribute their own information internally very widely. It's a pretty small group of people who really know what is happening at any one time. So that makes journalism all the more difficult because often the way you learn what's really happening is to triangulate from mid-levels of the bureaucracy toward the top, perhaps going outside to lobbyists and members of Congress and other sources where you may start to grope toward something like the shape of events. And here, that method is often less effective because people at the mid-level and in Congress often simply don't know what's happening.
Eric, in your reading of the Post and other newspapers, when you see a story that's portrayed as an exclusive, does that sort of make your ears perk up and wonder, where did that come from?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think, I'm not reporting the story. I don't know where it's coming from. I would suspect that Steve is right, that it's often not sort of officially condone leaks, but that doesn't mean that there's not some sort of overall agenda. It doesn't mean that the story is still balanced and fair. Oftentimes I think that you get a leak from somebody or you get information from somebody, we don't have to call it a leak, that sort of appears hot and it's exclusive and the person who's giving the information knows that. And I think what sometimes happens, and it's not all the time, but what happens with some regularity is that the piece then gets essentially overplayed because it's exclusive, and that the bit of information that's coming from one particular source it gets a sort of disproportionate amount of weight based on not the necessarily of the veracity of the information, but simply on the fact that nobody else has it.
Stephen, I wonder if you'd speak to the question about the unnamed senior administration official who keeps showing up in stories in almost every newspaper. Who is that person? Why is this charade even necessary?
Well, of course, there's more than one senior administration official, and the charade is frustrating. It's frustrating for readers, I'm sure. It should be frustrating for society at large. It's certainly frustrating for journalists. And there have been times, I remember Ben Bradley famously declared at one moment of heightened frustration that he was no longer going to participate in these ground rule bargains, which were, which date back to the Nixon administration, the Johnson administration, or before, in their current form. They go back all through the 20th century in Washington in many ways. And he declared a boycott, no more background briefings, no more senior administration officials. And it lasted about 4 days because you really couldn't run a newspaper that way in this town.
So it's just impossible to say that perhaps there should be a standard that if you're not willing to be on the record and quoted by name, we don't care what you have to say.
Well, we enforce that standard from time to time. I don't think that as a newsroom we do enough to put pressure on officials to draw them onto the record where possible. And it's really hard work. It's unrewarding work. It requires people like me to enforce editing standards that punish stories where that isn't done to the maximum possible degree. And frankly, you're also trying to perform a broader role of bringing information into the marketplace that wouldn't otherwise be there. I sort of agree with what Eric was saying about play of exclusive stories. Certainly that does happen sometimes. At the same time, put it in perspective. We're playing a constitutional role. We're trying to draw information out of a closed-off government on behalf of our readers. And it is really hard work, especially with this administration. We believe in that work, and it's imperfect when you're scratching and clawing for little bits and pieces under deadline that in an administration that, for instance, routinely classifies information that just ordinary, that really ought to be available to the public and the Congress. But in our system, they can classify arbitrarily and withhold information arbitrarily. That's part of the privilege of office. And so our role is to scratch at that. And as a result, the journalism you do is less transparent and more incomplete and more flawed than you would wish it to be. And yet you wouldn't want to stop doing it as a result of those frustrations.
All right, let's hear what some of your readers and some of our listeners have to say about this conversation. We go first to Beloit, Wisconsin, where Dwight is on the line. Hello, Dwight.
Yes, good morning. Fascinating show. I, as a reader, avid reader of maybe half a dozen newspapers every morning, the only information I have available to me is to simply look at what's printed in the paper. And curiously, if I look at the editorial page, for instance, they'll refer to Saddam Hussein as somebody who used chemical weapons against his own people, and then I look at the news articles, and they say the same thing. I look at the description of the war, and it's called Operation Iraqi Freedom. That appears in the editorial section, and it also appears in the article. So, and that's just a marketing term that the Bush people have put out instead of calling it what it really is without any adornment. So I don't know whether you guys meet with each other or not, but you sure use exactly the same terms. You portray things the same way. President Putin of Russia used chemical weapons against his own people within the last 2 years. Saddam Hussein did 15 years ago, using weapons provided by the United States. The editorial page does not mention that last part of it, and the news articles, you do not mention that. So if you're not talking to each other, you sure are of like mind.
All right. Thanks for the point, Dwight. What about that, Stephen?
Well, I mean, I think that that's, you know, that's an argument. That is a kind of a dialogue with the editorial page rather than with what most of the reporters in the newsroom go out and try to do. I mean, I think that the caller makes one important point about language, which is a real challenge for all of the media in a heavily managed war such as this one was, which is what language do you choose to use? Do you use the Bush administration's language? Do you use common sense neutral language? Do you use Iraqi language? You see a really fascinating version of this on the day that the Americans renamed the airport in Baghdad, which had been called Saddam International. And I forget whether it was the third ID that got there first, and they decided that they would call it Baghdad International. And there was a discussion in our newsroom about whether to change the dateline because we were filing stories out of the airport. Should it be called Saddam International Airport still? Should it be called Baghdad, as the Americans were renaming it, or something else? And I noticed that one major newspaper chose to punt, and they datelined it at the international airport, whatever it might be called. we went, you know, for better or worse, we went with Saddam on the grounds that it was still a sovereign government, so far as we could tell. They still had naming rights, so far as we were concerned, and we weren't going to unilaterally switch on the basis of a single general's declaration. But it's the kind of thing that comes up all the time.
Eric, what did you see as you looked at newspapers around the country? How did they handle that one?
I actually have to admit that happened on one of my days off, but I did notice that, and I think it, you know, I mean, I think it speaks to a difficult problem, which is that as much as people sort of talk about, or journalists talk about, neutrality and objectivity, that's a situation where, in, you know, when you're trying to convey something like that, there is no neutral term. I mean, you know, you can say at the airport, you know, you can punt, basically.
The unnamed airport,
right.
Whatever it might be.
Exactly. But, it's a difficult one. And I think it speaks to that the reality is that we as sort of journalists have to make decisions. And those decisions typically aren't really objective in a sense, or aren't really neutral. That doesn't mean they're wrong by any means, but we just simply have to make choices.
Stephen, what did you find as your biggest ethical dilemma during this war? Obviously, language is one of them, but what else were you wrestling with in that newsroom every day?
Well, I'm not sure that I'd call it ethical, but we had a lot of journalistic dilemmas, the most important of which was to try to deliver to the best of our ability a complete and balanced file from both sides of the line, and to try to see events from as many points of view as it was humanly possible to see them. Our role during a war is not really very complicated in one sense and enormously complicated in another. We're seeking to be honest, independent witnesses to large, complex, swirling events. The only way to be a useful witness is to get into position to see. And the only way to see is to try to see from all sides in as many dimensions as possible. So a lot of the logistics and management of the coverage day in and day out, while it may seem, you know, sort of removed from core journalism, in fact, getting into position to see the story from all possible angles, including both sides of the battle lines, that's the whole game from the newsroom's point of view.
You mentioned a moment ago the name of Ben Bradley, who was one of your legendary predecessors there. I have a favorite quote of his, which is, "We don't print the truth, we print what people tell us." And that's not to suggest that reporters don't try to get it right, but journalism is a messy business. It does take a while to sort out what's true or not, especially, as you say, if you're not there to witness it personally.
Yes, yeah, so it's a very rough, very early draft of events. And in wartime, though, you do have a luxury, I think, in newspapering that is often not available in routine coverage of Washington decision-making, for example, which is that you can get there and see it for yourself. There is nothing, the one thing that journalism can offer that nobody else on the battlefield can offer is independent, direct witnessing experience of events. And that means careful, neutral, forensic observation, and also a willingness to cock your ear to everybody who has a voice in the scene. And you have to be there to do that. And then you have to be able to write it in a clear and balanced and fair way. But you have to be there. And in fact, it's possible to deliver a lot more of that as a newspaper in an event like a war than it is, frankly, covering the Pentagon's budget decision-making day in and day out, where so much of the process is opaque and it's not possible to be a witness. You have to interpolate and rely on what people tell you.
Eric, just very quickly, what's your grade for the Times and the Post in their war coverage?
Oh, I think I'd give the Post probably a B plus, maybe a B, and the Times probably one step below that.
All right. Eric Umansky, thanks so much for joining us. Eric writes the Today's Papers column for Slate.com. Connection listeners, we're talking with Stephen Cole, the managing editor of The Washington Post and a Pulitzer Prize winner for explanatory journalism. He's currently at work on his fifth book, which is about the war in Afghanistan. In this war, did journalists keep the right distance from the White House and the Pentagon? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection. We're talking this hour with Stephen Cole, managing editor of The Washington Post, about editorial choices during the war in Iraq. Connection listeners, what is the role of newspapers in times of war, especially when television and the Internet provide a moment-to-moment account right from the battlefield? You can join in the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And let's go to our phone lines now from Providence, Rhode Island. We have Paul on the line. Hello, Paul. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. The recent opinion polls have shown that 45% of Americans believe that Iraq had something to do with 9/11. And this is deliberate conflation of the two phenomena or the two events by the Bush administration. How much responsibility does the media have to kind of debunk the president? And does the press have some responsibility in close to half of the U.S. public believing a lie?
All right, Stephen.
Well, there is a lot that we don't know about 9/11, but it's certainly true that the evidence of Iraqi involvement is thin at the very best. And while I do believe that a careful review of the New York Times and the Washington Post and the LA Times and other newspapers with the resources to cover these kinds of questions in depth would show that the record is pretty plainly laid out, the broad perception in the United States, which I think is or was may have been shared to some extent by the president and his cabinet, was that even though the evidentiary record was thin, they nonetheless suspected a connection. And I don't really know how to read those poll numbers. I'm as struck by them as the caller because they do seem rather high compared to the record that's available to us to date. And yet I wonder if part of what they reflect is simply an instinct that was shaped by the president's instincts and by the cabinet's instincts and by the power of their arguments in the months leading up to the war. I don't know.
What do you think about that, Paul? Do you think the story wasn't adequately covered, or do you think that the people who believe that there was a strong connection with Iraq perhaps weren't reading their newspapers?
No, I just believe it's like Noam Chomsky says, that when things don't fit the picture, they get resistance. And if they do go along with the kind of official line that there's no resistance, that the journalists didn't have much of a reason to want to vet the Bush administration's story in their line. And a lot of it was just conflation. Bush was often careful to not say that they caused it, but to just use it in the same sentence. So good journalism would have pointed to that this is just conflating these two issues.
All right. Thank you so much for the call, Paul.
Thank you.
Stephen?
You know, there's another part of that story. I think that the Bush administration did often conflate the two issues as it argued its case at the United Nations and elsewhere. At the same time, they were making a separate argument, which was prospective, whatever you think of it. It was not based on an evidentiary finding of Iraqi involvement in 9/11. It was based on the prospect of cooperation between Iraq and al-Qaeda, especially the danger of Iraq making weapons of mass destruction available to terrorists in the future. So now, again, I'm only pointing out that this was an argument that the Bush administration made, but I think it was more persuasive for many Americans than the evidentiary record about 9/11 itself.
So you don't think it's a question about the coverage? You think it was adequately covered?
No, I'm not. Well, I've made my defense for what it's worth. I think we did cover that issue in our pages, perhaps not as thoroughly as we should have, perhaps not as thoroughly as that caller would have liked. We did cover it. And certainly we're aware of what the record shows and does not show about the connection between Saddam Hussein and 9/11. I'm not aware of any convincing evidence of a operational involvement by Iraqi intelligence services or the Iraqi government with any of the 9/11 plotters. We could go back over that record and talk about it for hours. I know it in some detail. The only evidence that has surfaced seems so far not to have borne out. There are a few mysteries, not many. There is a loose history of interaction between elements of al-Qaeda and the Iraqi government that dates back to the mid-90s, but it does not lead you to the 9/11 plot, not any evidence that I've seen to date.
We were speaking a moment ago about the importance of having reporters there to provide some sort of independent eyes and ears to what's happening. But even when that occurs, there can be contradictions. For example, I'm thinking of the story. There was a Washington Post reporter there early on when there was an incident at a roadblock where the reporter said that there were 10 civilians, including 5 small children, who had been killed. And the Pentagon said there were only 7. I'm wondering, were you ever able to clarify that and get that cleared up?
Well, to our satisfaction, yes. Perhaps our follow-up reporting won't prove to be the last word, but the sequence of events is as you describe it. The reporter was William Brannigan was embedded with the 3rd Infantry Division, and he was with the unit that engaged in this encounter at the roadblock where they shot at a civilian vehicle, and he witnessed a captain who he was not at the checkpoint, but he was with a commander live during the event. He heard the dialogue that accompanied the shooting. He was with the soldiers in the immediate aftermath. He took their accounts. He saw the evacuation of the victims, and he filed his account, which had the number that I guess I don't remember the exact numbers, but 10, if that's what you recall. And even before we had gotten that story into the paper, because we believed that he was the only reporter who happened to be there when this occurred, Central Command, for whatever reason, perhaps because they knew the story was coming out anyway, issued a statement in Doha, which had a different number in it, 7. The next day, we published our story with 10, and we asked Bill to go back and make sure that we had the number right, because correcting the number would have been something we would have been happy to do to get it right. And he came back and said, look, I went back. I'm not being proud here, but it was 10. And so we reiterated that, I think, in the second day's coverage. And so far as I know, Central Command has never responded one way or another. When they were asked about it at a press briefing, they said, well, we have different channels of reporting and we'll follow up. Mm. And it just sort of faded away.
I do remember the story well. It was a very dramatic account of what happened there. How much of your planning going forward is about this whole issue of there were any number of accounts that I guess we can chalk up to the famous fog of war? Do you feel obliged to go back and look at the coverage to any stories that might need follow-up clarification, try to put them more into the big picture?
Well, in a broad sense, yes. We have a lot of work left to do in on this story, both covering current events and the following up on the premises of the conflict and the pledges and the attempts to implement those pledges that the American government has made. You know, I think to some extent the measure of coverage of subjects like this really must extend well beyond the violent events themselves and to the aftermath. And this is not glamorous reporting sometimes. It's expensive. It requires commitment. But we intend to keep reporters on the ground, as I'm sure other big newspapers will, for many months to come. And we will be digging backwards as well as reporting currently. We've, for instance, kept a reporter as an analogy in Afghanistan for ever since the events of that fall, and the great majority of American media organizations have long ago gone home. So the whole question of what impact the conflict in the fall of 2001 has actually had on Afghanistan, to what extent we really understood that in the fall, you know, has been left to a couple of newspapers to follow up on with single correspondents. It's and that's really where the important work gets done sometimes, I think.
Was this a particularly difficult war to cover because for the first time there were these constant demands to satisfy public interest in the story? Your competition was 24-hour television and instant information on the Internet. How much did that, if at all, alter the Post's approach? Because I do know that you had continuous updates throughout the day.
Right. Well, we try not to fight technology, but to embrace it. And we have a website, WashingtonPost.com, that is very important to the future of the newspaper and even to its present. We have more readers on the web than we have in print right now. And the web is a different medium from a newspaper. It is a faster, continuous medium. And the trick for us in the newsroom, and this war was a model and a kind of experiment, one in a series, but the most robust, is to adapt our resources and our culture and our traditions and our sense of what we do to this new medium without undermining the qualities and the values that we brought into this in the first place and that are central to the newspaper every day. So that means working a little faster, filing more often, but not surrendering your standards. And it also means working outside of just words and working a little more with pictures and video and audio where that seems viable.
How much do you worry about your morning coverage being overtaken by events, particularly in a situation like a war where events are coming at you pretty quickly?
Well, there's two aspects of that. One, we try to deliver a file every 24 hours that is going to hold up over the course of the next 24 hours, that has sources of exclusive information, exclusive perspective, analytical depth, and also sheer variety and completeness that no other medium and only a handful of other newspapers could match. So in that sense, we must continue to deliver a file that has those characteristics. Otherwise, we won't have a role in people's lives. At the same time, we have to amend that model so that it isn't unnecessarily stale throughout the day, and the web is the way that we do that. It's a sort of a synthetic approach, as it has to be.
Do you think that the public and perhaps the press will have a different regard for the military now that we've seen such vivid reporting about life in the tanks and in the trenches?
I don't know. I mean, it's a good question. I don't know the answer to it. I think that, you know, a lot of the American people probably had a pretty high opinion of the professional military. I think what changes with the kind of coverage that you saw during these 3 or 4 weeks is, you know, just a sense of humanization, intimacy, and specificity that arises when you see real lives and real experiences documented in that way. You know, it really isn't, I don't think, the kind of reaction that sort of thumbs up or thumbs down. It's not as if people are rating the military in some sort of professional sense. It's the humanization of war and of a soldier's experience that is really unusual and really quite powerful.
You mentioned a moment ago about how the big stories in some ways are easier to cover. You know, you have a certain amount of adrenaline-fueled excitement that kicks in and keeps you going during those 20-hour days. Do you anticipate an easier road ahead for yourself and your staff over the next 6 months, or is it going to be difficult to keep going and maintain an interest in the stories that are yet to come?
Well, I think that's it. You've got to, you know, the natural cycle is one of ebbing away, especially after the adrenaline rush of the last sort of month or so. There is an instinct to abandon that we have to resist, and it's sort of my job, among other things, to push us forward along with my colleagues, because the real story, the deepest story, I think, is still ahead of us.
Stephen Cole, we thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Stephen Cole is the managing editor of The Washington Post, hard at work on his fifth book on the war in Afghanistan. Earlier we talked with Eric Umansky, who writes the Today's Papers column for Slate.com. And Connection listeners, you can continue the conversation online at our website, theconnection.org. The Connection is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Elaine Grant, Kelly Jones, Orit Karitsky-Fox, Lindsay Miller, Christina Russo, and Doug Shugarts. Our interns are Danya Akkad, Andrea Liebman, and Lisa Rufino. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection.